This is a Zach Feldman Show replay on ZRadioLive.com.
The website music station Z Radio Live. This is the Zach Feldman Show. Joining me over the phone is a lawyer. He is not here to sue me, thank God. His name is Brian Addisman, and he is part of the law firm Miller Addisman. Hey, man, how you doing? Thanks for joining me here on the Zach Feldman Show.
I'm doing all right. Thanks, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Just to make sure, you're not here to serve me, right?
Not at the moment.
Oh,
things could change. They're moving in real time, so who knows?
But we are here to talk about your new firm and your firm that's been going on for a while called Miller Addisman. You know, tell us all about the firm. When did it start? How did it create? How'd you create it?
Yeah, basically, so I was working at a big law firm for about 5 years after law school, representing, you know, mostly big corporations, corporate America. We did have some individual clients, like I know early on I had a case with Jay-Z, which was pretty cool, where we represented him when he was sued for the song Big Pimpin'. But
what happened in that case, actually? I wanted to know. I'm curious about that.
So in that case, it's actually kind of interesting. Big Pimpin', the underlying melody that, like, bum 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 dun dun dun, song called Kosara Kosara, and it's actually an Egyptian love song, and the whole song's about just, you know, how, like, beautiful this woman is, how in love the singer is with this woman. And Timbaland found it. I believe I'm getting the facts right. This is so long ago, so I might be getting some of this wrong, but basically Timbaland found that sample in like a free sample bin at Sam Goody. Remember Sam Goody?
Oh yeah,
the music store from the 90s. And they would have, like, free samples in a bin. So he found it, he liked it, he turned it into the beat for Big Pimpin'. Jay-Z, you know, made the song over it. And then Sony, like, did all the paperwork. They got the rights to the song, everything was above board. And then basically, like, 7 to 10 years, I want to say, after the song came out, the composer of Kosara Kosara died, and his son inherited all of his catalog, the music rights to his catalog. And then I'm sure, obviously, maybe a lawyer approached him, or he approached the lawyer, and they thought, like, wait a second here, Big Pimpin' made all this money, we only got so much money for the rights, like, let's sue. And so they sued, and they had some, like, sort of clever legal arguments about Egyptian copyright law, saying, you know, basically, like, under Egyptian copyright law, even when you give license to a song, you always retain the rights to what are called moral rights, which is unique to Egyptian law. American law, we don't have the same type of moral rights.
So moral rights, kind of like, oh, you know, I gave you the rights to it, but morally, these are actually, it's actually my song, you know, like.
it's more like a reservation of rights to reserve an objection to anything done with the song that's morally objectionable.
So that seems so, like, it seems so, how do I explain it? Like, I guess, like imaginary.
You know? Yeah. So in American law, there are sometimes things referred to as moral rights, but they're totally different, not the same thing. And those rights don't exist in American law. I mean, you could, like, pre-negotiate, I guess, like, I want to retain the right to object to it being used immorally in your, you know, agreement to license the music, but those rights don't inherently exist in American law. And so, but anyway, so in Big Pimpin', the song was, the background track of Kosara Kosara was kind of almost used ironically because it is a love song, and the song Big Pimpin' isn't about love necessarily, you know, it's kind of tells a different tale. And so it was kind of meant to be ironic that the song was in there. Anyway, it went all the way through trial, which is really rare for a case to do.
Yeah.
Jay-Z's testimony was awesome. He did perfect in front of a jury and won the whole case after, like, 10 years of litigating this. So
that's amazing. Thank God.
Timbaland too. So yeah, that was cool. So yeah, that was, like, early in my career we did that. And then, you know, and then, so yeah, after five or so years at the big firm, I decided I wanted to kind of branch out on my own and do more trials, which is rare to, you know, trials at big firms are kind of rare to come by. Although they do happen, they're just sort of rare. And so I branched out and started my own firm.
So what are the struggles for starting your own firm? I feel like it's like starting any business, but I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more legal to it.
Yeah, the struggles are infinite, essentially.
What are some of the things you had to go through?
Well, number one, it's hard, you know, sometimes to get clients because you're kind of starting from square one, and you know, you got to get people to trust you, and you got to find people who have cases, which is hard, especially because there are, you know, ethical rules around how you go about doing that that restrict you from doing certain things that would be easier to get clients.
Yeah, you can't just go up to some random person who you saw in the news got injured and just be like, hey, exactly, you know, let's go, you know, come help, come with me, I'll help you out, you know.
Yeah, that would be a big no-no. And so you can't do that. And then, I mean, you know, other things too, like there are just so many rules regulating lawyers. And when you're at a firm, like a big firm or established firm, you know, they already kind of have all the processes in place to make sure you're in compliance with those rules. But when you're on your own, it's like sometimes even difficult just to understand the full, you know, gambit of rules that apply to you, let alone making sure you're in compliance with all of them. So that's another challenging thing. I mean, there's just really endless number of challenging things about doing it on your own. Another really hard thing is like the law is a bit unique in that if you're taking cases on contingency fee, where you're basically only getting paid a part of the winnings, if you do win, you know, those cases can take anywhere from 1 to 7 years to complete. So you're not getting paid for, like, even if you have all amazing cases, all amazing clients, and you're the best lawyer in the world, you could be waiting to getting paid a cent for a very long time.
Yeah. And that must be hard too on a business who needs to pay their employees every single, you know, every single week or every biweekly.
Yeah. It's hard on a business, hard emotionally, you know, like you start to question, wonder if, like, you know, are you doing this right? Even again, even if you have the best cases in the world and you're doing everything right, you start to second guess yourself. It's it's a challenging business, I think.
You know, I mean, what got you started as a lawyer? What was your like big, okay, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life?
Yeah, I wish I had. I kind of have like an anti-story there. and that never really happened. I actually never really thought I was going to be a lawyer. I mean, I was told my whole life by basically everyone who met me, like, oh, you should be a lawyer when you grow up, which kind of turned me off from wanting to be a lawyer. I think that's pretty common with a lot of people, actually. in college, I wanted to be a talent agent. Mostly because I was watching a lot of Entourage at the time. Basically, every life career choice I've ever made has been tethered to whatever TV show I've been watching at the time. So, like, I've
that's a great way of looking at life, though.
Yeah, I mean,
just don't watch, like, Breaking Bad, though.
Yeah, that came out late enough to where I already was stuck being a lawyer, so I couldn't become a meth kingpin. But I applied to undergrad pre-med because I thought I was going to be a plastic surgeon because I was watching Nip Tuck, and then that switched to being a talent agent. And so then after college, I started working in the entertainment industry, and I was working for, you know, PR firms, and I'd worked for talent agencies. And then I thought, like, okay, well, maybe I don't want to be a talent agent. Maybe I want to actually, you know, like, I at that point recognized that all of my career choices had been sort of tethered to the TV I was watching. So I was like, maybe I don't want to be one of these characters on TV. Maybe I want to make content, make movies, make TV, because that was so inspiring to me. So I want to be a movie producer. And so then I went to law school at USC because you could take classes in the film school as a law student. I was like, okay, I'm going to be a movie producer. I'm not going to be a lawyer, which was really just a horrible idea. It's just so, again, all of my thoughts are like those of an 8-year-old.
Listen,
like,
I would have supported the movie career. I mean, I'm in the media industry. I love making videos and producing content and stuff like that. So I would have totally supported you on that. 100%.
Yeah. Well, if you ever need someone to produce a major motion film that you need help with, I'm the man. I'm your man.
I'll keep you posted too. I'll definitely keep you posted for the lawyer part of it. But you
know, yeah,
how did it shift to being a lawyer?
So I went in thinking I was going to be a producer. And then when you're in law school, you know, like, the whole law schools, for many reasons, they have many incentives, I guess you could say, to want to push people into becoming a lawyer. And wanting to become even a particular type of lawyer that has prestige, because that in part ties back to how they're ranked as a law school. And so the whole law school ecosystem is set up and designed to funnel students into this lawyer mold. And so I just, you know, I got sucked into that conveyor belt funnel system and got popped out a lawyer.
And do you love it? Are you passionate about it? Are you excited about it? Or are you just kind of like, you know, oh, this is a cool little experience to be doing, but you could totally do something different?
Yeah, you know, it's a hard question to answer. You know, like sometimes I love it, and there are some days I think, wow, this is so cool that I'm getting paid to do this. And then there are other days I think, like, you know, what story of this building am I on, and would I die if I jumped out the window, or would I just break my legs, you know? So it depends. It oscillates a lot. But yeah, I think, you know, I think for me personally, based on my inherent skill set, I don't think there is any better profession suited for me. And so I know I always have that to sort of rest my hat on and, you know, feel okay about what I'm doing, because I really don't think I'd be better doing anything else in the world. So yeah, it's good most of the time.
Well, your law firm is Miller Addisman, and I'm just curious, you know, like, what was like your big case? What was like the case that kind of put you guys on the map?
We recently filed a lawsuit against a very major health insurance company, basically alleging that it's a class action lawsuit, and it alleges that they've basically created this very rigorous set of standards to get reimbursement from a residential mental health treatment facility. So mm-hmm. basically, if you're a mental health facility, you have to meet all of these really, really burdensome standards if you want to get reimbursement from the health insurance company. And those same standards don't exist for physical health facilities. And that's illegal if you impose more rigid standards for mental health and physical health. And so we filed a class action against them alleging that. And yeah, it seems like the class actions are the ones that really get most like media attention and stuff. So
I feel like it's got that star power by saying it's a class action lawsuit, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a very tough suit to follow through. Would that be wrong? Or
yeah, no, they're difficult. They have definitely, class actions have their own procedural challenges, and I think they're all also difficult for when a company is hit with one. It's difficult to have to face that. Usually, you know, another reason why I think it's difficult for a lot of these like publicly traded companies is if the class action seems like they're under significant enough exposure, they then have to like disclose that to their shareholders and their, you know, SEC filings. Okay. That can complicate things. So yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons why the class actions are really important suits.
For those who want to get into being a lawyer or being, you know, a criminal justice lawyer or any type of law of lawyer, you know, what is some advice you would have for them?
I would definitely suggest a few things. First, understand what it actually means to be a lawyer. Like, don't be like me.
Basically. Don't just watch TV. Yes.
Yeah. Don't watch a lawyer show and think that looks fun, I'm going to do that. So do everything the opposite of what I did is my first piece of advice. And then once you do that, you know, other advice would be to really study for that LSAT, because if you can go to law school without taking on any debt, I would highly recommend that. Yeah, like, most of the time, if I know anyone on the fence about law school, that's almost always my advice to them is like, look, if you can see yourself doing anything other than being a lawyer and still feel okay about your life, then don't go unless you can do it debt free. If you can do it debt free, then you're really, you know, there's no pressure. Like, lottery is never going to hurt you. So that's true. What I usually tell people. So that'd be another piece of advice. If you know it's something you really want to do, study hard for that LSAT so you can get a full ride somewhere, get some good scholarship. It's a very doable test. It's one of those things that seems impossible when you first start it, and then you learn these little tricks and you realize, oh, this is just really a test of like 10 or 12 tricks that they've been doing the same test, you know, 150 years. I just have to learn the 10 tricks and I'm good. So don't get discouraged by that. And, you know, just be nice to me when I'm your opposing counsel, because I put up with enough people.
It's a small industry, you know, always be nice to everybody too. You know, I always wanted to be, or at least like dabble in being a lawyer of some sort. You know, I was never book smart in school. that's kind of where I went to the creative side, and I was more, you know, involved in that. But I feel like, you know, if I could just be a lawyer, if I could go back, maybe I would be able to do it. Maybe I wouldn't. I don't know. I feel like I'd do it, then I get into the debt, and then I'd fail at it, and then I have to go back to being a freaking, you know, whatever I am now, which is, you know, a videographer.
I think you definitely could do it. I have no doubt you could do it. And you can do it well. Because if you can interview someone, that's like, you know, if you're a trial lawyer, that's half of what you do.
That's true.
But the better question is, you know, would you have been happier doing that than what you're doing now? I don't know.
That's true. I think I just like the idea of like you're at the stand and you're like kind of, it's kind of like a show, you know, it's kind of like you're putting on a play in a sense, you know?
Yeah, but you also have to remember you are referencing trial, which is like the number one most fun part about being a lawyer, and happens like once every 2 years if you're lucky.
Does it
for a week?
I feel like that happens more often than not. But I guess you're right about that then.
I should actually qualify that statement. If you're doing like criminal law and you're like a public defender, or you're a prosecutor, or you're, you know, even a private criminal defense attorney, then you are in trial way more than I just suggested. Yeah. If you're doing civil law, which is like, you know, lawsuits, you know, 99.999999 something, you can look up the number, but it's a 99.9 number of cases either settle or are disposed of before trial.
Yeah, so it's they just go into that negotiation period where they're just like, okay, before we go to trial, let's just talk about money. You know, maybe we can get out of this before money.
And it's very common too for cases to settle on the morning of trial. Like, you'll be ready to go trial. You'll literally walk into the courthouse with your opening statement, and you'll settle on the courthouse steps. That's very common too. Because, you know, like, it's just, juries are so unpredictable. Both sides recognize, like, look, we could be looking at like $1 billion judgment here for some stupid, silly thing, or we could be looking at nothing for all this work that we put into, you know, let's settle this. So there's incentive, strong incentive on both sides to settle before trial.
I was going to ask you too. I mean, obviously I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know, but it kind of seems like when they get into that period where it's, you know, let's negotiate the money aspect before we get into trial, I feel like that's kind of them saying like, okay, we know we're wrong, you know, let's settle some money. Why can't that hold up in court itself?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. That's your intuition, because you're right that there is amongst usually, and I don't mean this in like a derogatory sense, but usually that is a presumption, I would say, amongst lay people, like non-lawyers, because I think lawyers understand that there's a million and one reasons why any party would want to settle. But yeah, so that is a common misperception. And exactly for what you just said, that's your intuition, is why there is a rule in every jurisdiction, I would think. I'm pretty confident in every jurisdiction that you can't bring up the fact that someone offered to settle, or how much was offered at settlement, or anything really about settlement at trial, for that reason. Because, yeah, basically there's a catch-all rule also at any trial, which says basically if the evidence you're trying to bring in is going to be so unduly unduly prejudicial that it outweighs its probative value, it can't come in. Basically, like, if it's going to do more confusion and unnecessary harm, or harm for the wrong reasons, than it does good, it doesn't get in. And so settlement has its own rule about you can't talk about settlement, but it's because of that very reason that, you know, it doesn't suggest that either side thought they were wrong necessarily. And a jury might think that, so you can't talk about it. It also, you know, if you were allowed to talk about settlement at trial, well, then no one would ever try to settle, ever, because they'd be like, I don't want a jury to hear this. So it's another reason why.
That is interesting. And you know what? Thank you for bringing some insight from the lawyer area into my brain, because I'm just like, I always wondered that. I was like, I feel like that just itself is the grounds to saying, okay, yeah, I fucked up, you know?
Yeah,
let's fix this.
On the same note, another thing that's usually, again, this is certainly true in most jurisdictions. I think it's probably true in all jurisdictions, but usually, if not always, you can't bring up the fact that somebody has apologized. Like, if you get in a car accident and you go up and you run up to the person you hit and go, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, are you okay, I'm so sorry, that wouldn't be admissible at trial, for the same reason that, you know, number one, we don't want to disincentivize people from apologizing. It's just bad public policy. And number two, just because you say you're sorry doesn't necessarily mean you were legally at fault, especially before you consulted a lawyer. And so we don't want a jury to, you know, misunderstand that. So there's a lot of things like that that, you know, and there's a lot of things that are allowed in that I think personally, I think should be excluded for that same reason. But, you know, I'm not ruler of the world.
Fair enough.
I don't make the rules.
Well, Brian, seriously, thank you so much for joining us here, giving us a little bit of insight into your knowledge on the whole law and talking about your brand new law firm, Miller Addisman. You know, tell us, where can people find you? Where can people hire your firm? And where can they keep in touch with you?
Yeah, so my website's under construction right now, unfortunately. But I think if you go to it, you can still find my email, which is millerattisman.com. You can find me there. That's MILLERAD as in David, E as in Eric, S as in Sam, MAN.com. And you can also find me on Twitter, Brian Addisman, spelled the same, no spaces, no periods, no hyphens. And you could message me there, or tweet at me, or say whatever you want to me there. It's free.
Awesome.
Free platform.
Well, I will be contacting you definitely for my next litigation if I ever have one.
Yeah,
hopefully we won't have to. But just
if you
in
do
case,
have to, feel free to give me a call for
I'll
sure.
be taking your business card after this interview for sure.
Absolutely.
Brian Addisman, sure. A lawyer, part of Miller Addisman. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Zach Feldman Show. Best of luck with the law firm.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Anytime. The WebC Music Station, Z Radio Live, back with more Zach Feldman Show after this.
Want to hear more? Listen to the Zach Feldman Show every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on ZRadioLive.com.